is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Riley, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this February 18 panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. In this case on for oral argument is the matter of the civil commitment of Maurice Williams. Counsel, as you are aware, I will state for the record, the proceeding today is not live at the Minnesota Judicial Center, but is instead being entertained on the internet Zoom platform. I state this so that counsel can be aware that although we can see each other now and we can see each other's names, there will be no video recording either by the court or, according to rule, by anyone else of the proceeding today. So in order to keep track for our audio recording of the proceedings, who's making which argument, we ask that you state your name before you commence each leg of your argument. Each of you has 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that for rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you may.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court. My name is Victoria Herr, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Maurice Williams. Your Honor, there are two issues before the court today. The first issue is whether the trial court erred in finding that the appellant is mentally ill and dangerous, where the prerequisite for a valid waiver is not clearly displayed in the record, and the court order did not make a finding in its August 10th, 2020 order that appellant had made a voluntary and intelligent waiver. The second issue is whether the district court erred in finding that the appellant continued to meet the statutory definition of mentally ill and dangerous if the initial commitment order is procedurally and substantively defective with respect to the waiver. Your Honor,
is it fair to say that both of your issues hang on the first one?
Yes, Your Honor, it does. On whether or not whether the appellant had made a voluntary and intelligent waiver.
And so I'm clear, if we were to conclude that your client did make a voluntary and intelligent waiver, we would affirm across the board.
Yes, Your Honor, if that is the decision of the court.
Counselor, you seem to be arguing criminal principles in a civil proceeding, and I'm not sure you ever gave the district court a chance to deal with this under Rule 60 on a motion to vacate the stipulation. Why should we even hear this?
Well, Your Honor, this is not an attempt by the appellant to withdraw his stipulation. This is an appeal from the record itself that the stipulation was never effective because he was not competent at the time of the hearing and did not make a voluntary and intelligent waiver, and that the record supports that because the prerequisite of a valid waiver was not clearly displayed in the court transcript, and there is no finding in the actual court order that the stipulation made by the appellant on that date was voluntarily and intelligently made.
But if that's the issue, take it back to the district court. You know, the other side has a right to the stipulation that was entered in both proceedings, actually, and was supported by the testimony of the examiners in both proceedings.
Yes, Your Honor, and I can appreciate that, but you know, this is a unusual case in that I'm the third attorney appointed on this file. The attorney that appeared at the initial probable cause hearing has retired. In the interim, there was another attorney that was appointed to represent him at the 60-day review hearing to see if he continues to meet statutory criteria for commitment as mentally ill and dangerous. And then that attorney did not feel that it would be ethical for him to represent the appellant on an appeals issue on whether or not the waiver was valid.
How does the different attorneys representing your client at different times affect the procedural concern that Judge Kirk has raised?
Well, I believe that the transcript and the record at the 60-day hearing in which the second counsel argued that the appellant should not have been permitted to stipulate to the commitment without the appointment of a second examiner, and his request to have a second examiner appointed and granted by the court was in fact that counsel's attempt to insinuate and create a record that the waiver that was entered into was not proper and was not valid before the court.
Counsel, it seems to me what you're asking this court to do basically is to vacate that part of the commitment that relates to dangerousness and somehow convert this to just a regular mentally ill petition, which he had already faced at the time that he is apparently was accused of assault. Is that the remedy you're really seeking? Because that certainly doesn't seem appropriate. It would seem if there is a problem, we send it back and the court gets to decide if he's dangerous or not, as well as mentally ill or chemically dependent.
Your Honor, for clarification, I am seeking the opportunity to have the stipulation vacated on the premise that there was no proper stipulation, as the record does not clearly reflect all of the prerequisites for a valid waiver, and that the appellant have the opportunity to have a hearing on the merits of the petition. In addition, the appellant has been previously committed as mentally ill and dangerous and or chemically dependent in the past. At the time of the July 2nd hearing, it was not clearly explained to him that the current petition was different and that the terms of the commitment would be indeterminate based on the client's cognitive status, his mental illness, and the fact that he was determined to be incompetent to withstand trial due to his rapid decomposition. He did not understand that by adding the term dangerous to the petition, that the commitment would be indefinite. This is reflected, his confusion is reflected in the transcript on page 3 and 4 of the July 2nd hearing, in which the his attorney inquired of him as to whether or not he understood the indeterminate nature of the commitment that he was agreeing to. And his response was, Your Honor, if I may take a moment, his response was, and then he was interrupted that there would be no end date, and his response was okay. Also notable in support of the fact that, you know, the client wasn't competent at the time of this hearing to agree when the court examiner was asked if she believed he had the capacity and the competency to understand everything that he was agreeing to. Her response was that he was competent to the issue of him needing and agreeing to go to treatment. That is a very different and distinctive testimony of competency, because she's not testifying that he's competent to understand the indeterminate nature of the petition before him that he's agreeing to, only that he was competent to agree that he needs treatment and was agreeing to go to treatment. Also reflected in that transcript, Your Honor, is that even when the counsel was telling him that by agreeing to the petition, he would be going to St. Peter's. The appellant was making requests to go to a different hospital. So it's apparent that if anything, whether the stipulation was voluntary, it was not intelligent. And the record clearly reflects that. One of the cases that the county relies on is the case in the commitment of Rano. And in that particular case, it's different from this case. In that particular case, there is a clear record of an intelligent and voluntary waiver. In that particular case, the record supports that the attorney clearly explained the difference between his prior mental illness commitment versus the mentally ill and dangerous commitment, and the difference in that the commitment under the mentally ill and dangerous would be indeterminate. That was clear on the record as reflected in that court order. In addition, that appellant had a basis to stipulate to that, and that was that he had pending criminal charges that would come into play if he was not in agreement with the civil commitment. None of those facts exist in this particular case.
Why wasn't there a criminal case that would come into play here? He was facing the assault 2 charge as to the attack with the golf club, wasn't he?
But it was not conditioned. There was no condition that those charges will be dropped if he agreed to the commitment, as in the Rano case. So that was the difference.
No, go ahead. I'd like you to finish your answer to Judge Kirk before I ask another question.
He was merely referred for civil commitment due to being found incompetent to withstand his criminal trial.
Going back, stepping back from the merits for a moment and taking you back to where we began the discussion with Judge Kirk's questions, is it fair to characterize your argument as an effort to allow your client to withdraw his stipulation?
Your Honor, it would be fair to say that, because there was no valid stipulation as reflected in the transcript, in the records, or in the court order. There was no finding of a stipulation being voluntarily and intelligently made, and the record does not contain the prerequisites of a valid waiver.
In light of that, can you respond to the state's argument that Rule 6002 is really the avenue of your challenge, not this appeal?
Well, Your Honor, I did look at the Rule 60, and it's giving the client the opportunity to withdraw a stipulation if there were misrepresentation, fraud, duress, new evidence, and none of those appears to be the case. What appears to be the case is that the record clearly does not reflect, and neither does the court order, reflect that there was a valid stipulation ever entered into. And I see that I have 2 minutes, but if there's no questions left at this point, I would just argue that the U.S. Supreme Court has consistently held that the requirement that the prerequisites of a valid waiver be fully displayed on the record, and that is found in the case Boykin versus Alabama, and involuntary commitments are constitutional so long as they follow proper procedure and follow proper evidentiary standard. And the fact that his entire commitment is based on a stipulation that the record does not reflect contain all of the prerequisites of a valid waiver, and there is no finding that his stipulation was voluntarily and intelligent, would indicate that proper procedure and evidentiary standards were not met. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have an additional 5 minutes, Ms. Herr, for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. Heather Pipenhagen on behalf of the Dakota County Attorney's Office. We are the respondent in this matter. First and foremost, it is our position that this matter should be dismissed or relief should be denied because this is an issue, as I think Ms. Herr finally conceded towards the end of her argument, where she is asking that appellant, that the vacation, that the stipulation be vacated. And this motion should have been first brought in district court rather than be brought to this court. It could have been done through a Rule 60 motion. I guess Ms. Herr is kind of saying none of the things that Rule 60 covers would allow for that stipulation to be vacated. And that, you know, that's a whole nother issue. And that's what the district court would look at. And we would agree with that, frankly. But she still needs to bring that motion in district court so the district court can rule on it. And then this court can determine if the court abused its discretion.
So what's your position on the concern, or should we be concerned that, as you've said, the county's position, of course, is going to be that none of the elements of Rule 60 are met here, so the stipulation can't be undermined on that basis. Should there be a concern of ours that since there's no remedy into Rule 60, that this appeal is the appropriate approach?
No, Your Honor, because again, I mean, that is something that can be, you know, our position may be that there's no basis to vacate the stipulation because our argument is going to be there was no fraud or duress, which is the standard for vacating a stipulation. That doesn't deprive them of their ability to litigate that. There's also just a general interest of justice exception under Rule 60 that the district court could apply. But frankly, there is no basis, and I'll just move on then to the next issue, is whether or not this was a valid stipulation. And as I think Justice Kirk already alluded to, appellant is applying the principles that surround a criminal plea and the validity of a criminal plea to a civil stipulation for judgment. And it's not, the standard is not the same. The Rannell case and several other cases have clearly outlined that it is not the same standard. There isn't any specific requirement that the district court make findings about a party's competence to agree to a stipulation or the validity of a stipulation when it wasn't challenged in district court. There was no basis for the court to address those findings or to make those findings. As far as the validity of the stipulation, the appellant acknowledged on the record that he'd had conversations with his attorney prior to the hearing about the petition and the consequences of his stipulation. He acknowledged that he spoke with the examiner prior to the hearing, Dr. Kenning. He acknowledged his understanding of the whole process with the 60-day review and that there would be a review in 60 days, and that would be when the order would become indeterminate or final. His attorney explained to him that these are not like regular MI commitments that he was very familiar with in the past, that these have no end date. He acknowledged that. And he also acknowledged an understanding that he could not agree to the commitment. He could ask for a second examiner and have another hearing down the road. So all of that was covered with his attorney. There's no, frankly, the appellant doesn't even argue fraud or duress, simply says he didn't understand. And there just is really no basis to undo the stipulation on that basis, either for this court to do it or for the district court to do it, frankly. Furthermore, I guess I absolutely disagree with the characterization that at the second hearing, that his attorney's request for a second examiner at the time of the 60-day review was an equivalent to a motion to vacate the judgment. That is not what his attorney was saying. His attorney was saying, I should still have a right to a second examiner for purposes of the 60-day review. And that's not really an issue for this court. The district court agreed essentially with the county's position that he wasn't necessarily entitled to that, but allowed him to have a second examiner anyway. But there was certainly no motion to vacate the stipulation at that hearing or at the 60-day hearing that occurred about a month later. There was no challenge to, as I indicated, no challenge to appellant's competency at the time of the hearing. So it's not surprising that the district court did not address that in its findings. There's a characterization that Dr. Kenning's testimony about his ability to understand what was going on is not sufficient. She was asked if he had the ability to enter into this agreement or understand what's going on. I can't remember. The word competence was not used, but there was a phrasing of that. She was essentially asked if he was competent to agree to that. And she indicated that he was able to make decisions about entering into treatment and his options for the commitment process. And I do not interpret Dr. Kenning's response in the same way that appellant interprets that. I think Dr. Kenning chose her words carefully because, as this court's probably very familiar with Dr. Kenning, she practices in criminal court on competency cases regularly, also in the commitment arena. So I think she was being very careful to stay in her lane when she was asked that question and say, he is competent to make decisions for purposes of this proceeding and how to proceed in this proceeding. In other words, she wasn't weighing in on his competence on the criminal matter, which is something that appellant was very focused on during the commitment process. So I interpret her question as simply staying in her lane on the commitment process, not at all limiting his ability to enter into the agreement, which is the way it's being characterized. And I absolutely disagree with the remedy. I guess I'm a little confused now. I think the remedy being requested today by appellant is different than the remedy that was requested in the brief. And so I guess I'll just address the remedy for today, which is vacating the stipulation and place it back on for hearing. If this court were to find that it's even properly before you, that would be the remedy. It would go back and then the county would have the opportunity to prove up the petition. We never had the opportunity to prove up the petition because we weren't required to when the appellant entered into the stipulation. And for the same reason, the district court wasn't required to make initial findings because of the stipulation. The court never weighed any evidence. The court simply accepted the agreement. So all of that entire process would have to start over. The appellant would go back to the Dakota County Jail and the proceedings would start again. So that is obviously inconsistent with the remedy being requested in the brief. And I addressed in my brief that the remedy being requested in appellant's brief was not the appropriate remedy. If you're asking for a dismissal, then you can at the same time ask for a different type of commitment. I guess that's it for the remedy. As far as the final issue, the sufficiency of the evidence to support the indeterminate commitment at the 60-day hearing, I know the briefs, appellant's brief didn't touch much on that, and there wasn't much on it in appellant's argument here today, but I would just rest on the record on that. There was overwhelming evidence to support the indeterminate commitment at the 60-day hearing. It was fully supported by the examiners. Unfortunately, appellant his illness had not improved. It had worsened to some extent by the time we had reached the 60-day hearing. And so there was certainly evidence to continue that commitment. And the fact that he didn't commit a new assault while he was in that controlled environment, it is not a basis for this court to find there wasn't sufficient evidence. So unless the court has any other questions, I would rely on the arguments in my brief to the extent I haven't addressed them here in oral argument and forfeit the rest of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Pippenhagen. Doesn't appear as if either of the other panel members or myself has any questions for you. Any rebuttal?
Your Honor, just that I would concede that the remedy being sought.
And if you could just for the record, restate your name for us.
Yes, Your Honor, this is Victoria Herr. I would concede that the remedy that is being sought today is that the stipulation be vacated. I would disagree with the respondent or the county's position that Dr. Canning was trying to stay in her lane when she indicated that the client, that the appellant was competent to the extent of agreeing to treatment and indicating that he needed treatment. I think that the question presented to her was very clear, and it was whether or not he was competent to agree to the indeterminate commitment and understands it all. And her response was very narrow, and it was that he was competent to the extent of understanding that he needs treatment and wanting to go to treatment. She did not testify that he was competent as to the indeterminate commitment and understanding what that entails. Also, at the time of that hearing, Dr. Canning's report was not available. It was not completed, but in her report, which was completed at a later time, it clearly illustrates that the client was not competent, that he was mentally ill, that he was making disorganized communications, couldn't follow the interviews, couldn't maintain the line of questioning, and that she did not think that he was competent during the time of that interview. All of that goes to the heart of the issue, is that anytime, whether it is in a criminal matter or a civil matter, if an appellant is making a stipulation and admitting to them, that waiver needs to be intelligent and needs to be voluntary before a court can accept the waiver. Even if we were not deciding the merits of the case or the petition due to that stipulation, the bare minimum requirement would have been for the court to find whether or not that stipulation was voluntarily and intelligently entered into. And that all of the prerequisites of a valid waiver needs to be fully displayed on the record. A silent record is not sufficient to support a valid waiver or any
Ms. Herr,
attempts to do that.
Ms. Herr, I, whether under Rule 60 or some other process, when was the first time you raised the challenge to the validity of the stipulation?
Your Honor, when I review the documentation and when the case was passed on to me, I was under the impression that the second attorney on the case has raised that at the 60 review hearing, in which he says that it is an extension of the first hearing because the client shouldn't have been permitted to make that stipulation without the appointment of a second court examiner, that for purposes of that hearing, the attorney was looking at that 60 review hearing as an extension of the first hearing.
Let me be more clear. When is the first place in the record that we can identify clearly a challenge being made by your client to the validity of a stipulation?
Your Honor, other than what I have outlined, the record in this particular case is absent in a lot of areas, including a clear, you know, did that attorney specifically said, I want to vacate or challenge?
As a matter of process, regardless whether we're looking at it under Rule 60 or some other basis, how would we conclude that the district court erred as a matter of law or abused its discretion by accepting the stipulation if the district court was never asked, never presented with a challenge to the stipulation? How can we say the district court erred?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that...
Assuming that the criminal standard does not apply to civil proceedings. Your time is up, but you can answer the question.
Your Honor, I believe that the district court had a duty to make the finding that the waiver was intelligent and voluntarily entered into. It did not do that. And I believe that...
And the basis for your belief is what law?
Your Honor, there isn't a... I was not able to find any specific case law on that issue or with respect to commitments in civil cases and withdrawn stipulations, to be specific. All of the cases that I was able to find had some sort of connections to criminal proceedings. However, it is clear that regardless of the underlying case, whether it's civil or criminal, the prerequisites of a valid waiver still requires that it be fully displayed on the record for it to be acceptable.
Thank you. I believe your argument is fully articulated, and we appreciate your argument, and the same for Ms. Pippenhagen. Thank you for your argument on behalf of the council. The matter is submitted and under advisement. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period.